This is the last of our Mystic mini-lectures for lunch, and it's really been fun. I've enjoyed it greatly, and we're finishing up with a really great saint who's actually putting into practice mysticism and serves as a wonderful illustration for us and guide. I'm finishing up the training in Shalem, and our last of the readings have to do with Teresa of Avila.
What is that?
Shalem is for spiritual direction in Washington, D.C. So I have recently been going through the interior castle. It got tough to read, so I downloaded it on audiobooks. It got really tough and almost dangerous to drive with as I tried to stay awake. I went back to the reading, and I found I was really struggling. And then one of the other the students who's in the program now but is a graduate of Shalem, she explained to me why Teresa had to write that way. And so it was really fascinating to get into some of the historical background of the oppression that was going on for Teresa during the Inquisition. I'm sure you're going to get into some of that. But then I began to realize what a treasure Teresa is for the mystical contemplative way. Some of you are into centering prayer, and she really serves as that person who guides us with centering prayer, because throughout church history it's been a question of whether or not you can practice the contemplative life or if it's a gift that's just given by the Holy Spirit. And Teresa and St. John of the Cross give us the idea that there are at least some things that we can do. So, Cecilia, thank you so much for coming to us all the way from Connecticut.
Thank you to Dave Scheider for inviting me to be part of this series. I just happened to mention to him spontaneously that I was interested in mysticism, and he said that he had a series going on just this topic. So that was a lovely coincidence. And I'm enjoying being part of the center on Saturdays. I go to chapel and I go to lunch with some of you, and that's been good for me. I also want to thank those of you here at the seminary and at St. David's Church who have been so kind to me during this long time I've been in Austin and attached to the seminary. And I perhaps would like to say a special mention to someone who's in the room right now, and that's Dwayne Carter, who's been so good to me in the library for years and years, far more than 2 years. And I also would like to thank Yvonne Bieber and Vicki Perkins and Cynthia Kittredge for making me welcome here. So you might know that I'm writing a book on Augustine. I'm writing a book on readers of Augustine's confessions through the ages. And one of those readers is Teresa. So this is an unusual book in the sense that I didn't plan to write it. I just figured it out at a later stage that many of my favorite writers claimed Augustine's confessions to be their favorite book. This was often the only thing that they had in common. Many of them hated each other's views or hated each other, but nevertheless, it's been a great study for me. So I'm usually very textual in my approach, and this subject of the readers of Augustine's Confessions has forced me to be more historical, which is actually my earlier training. And so preparing for this talk, I was asking myself a few questions. Wanted to know, for example, why did Teresa become a saint? Was she in some ways predetermined to become a saint? There's something about her life background. Wanted to know, in what ways was she very Spanish, not just European? Was she part of her time or not part of her time? Is she a typical mystic? And what does it mean anyway to be a typical mystic? And really, the question that you probably came in here with and that I have every day when I read is, how can this help me as I read this text? What is the relevance of this study for me in my own studies or actually in my own life, which is where it begins? So I want to start by talking about Teresa herself. She was a great reader. And she was a fabulous writer, as you probably know. And so I'll begin by talking about her in literary terms. I'm going to give you several different ways to think about her, several different categories. So to begin, she is a major European writer, and that's unusual. Most of the mystics are not counted in that particular canon. And so I wanted to just briefly set the context for that. She was born about the time that Machiavelli was entering his prime. This is considered to be the rise of the Renaissance in Florence, which is the start of the Renaissance. She was also born about 100 years before the publication of Don Quixote, which is considered to be the greatest work of literature in the Spanish language. And her dates are 1515 to 1582. So we have to think about her in her historical context as well. Her life was bound by three Spanish rulers. We have Ferdinand and Isabella, who were just ending their reign as she was born, and Philip II, who was very much in power during most of her adult life. I want to tell you one thing about Queen Isabella, which was that she was highly literate and that she was a power. It was Ferdinand Isabella who ruled, not just the husband. And one detail I'll tell you about Queen Isabella is that she and her daughters all read Latin, and they also all spoke in Latin at home. I just give you this as an iconic example of how Spanish upper-class women of this time, wealthy Spanish women, were educated as girls and tended to continue to read into their adult lives. Well, about the time that Teresa turned 40, Philip II became King of Spain. He was by far the most powerful ruler in Europe, and he's known for many things, good and bad. He's known for improving the roads, and that was good because she spent most of her life traveling just with a cart and a mule, spreading her story throughout Spain. But he's also known for persecution of the Jews and persecution of the Muslims and for the Spanish Inquisition. And so the story about Spain at this time is mixed. It was becoming incredibly wealthy because of gold and silver coming in from the colonies, and yet this wealth was certainly not shared equally. There was great suffering at the lower end. The poor people were very poor indeed, and the wealthy had spectacular wealth, probably not known in Europe on that level, at least since the fall of ancient Rome. So Teresa was formulating her counterculture ideas at a time when there was the most authoritarian ruler in power in her country. And so this caused a lot of friction at the time. So I want to talk to you now about her religious position. And I mean it in a sort of institutional or theological sense to begin. We tend to think of her as a writer, rightly, but she also was involved in reformulating the Carmelites, this Catholic order, first the Carmelites for women, and then the Carmelites for men. She felt that the order, and in fact all Catholic orders in her time, had become too lax. Well, I suppose a counter-argument might be that children of the upper class, especially second and third sons and daughters, were regularly sent to these monasteries and convents to become the leaders, to become the prioresses, to become the mother superiors, for example. But Teresa was deeply offended by the idea of convents being something akin, in our terms, to sororities for the well-bred. And she felt that this was not the right way for institutions of God to perform their service for themselves and for society. And so Teresa had been born just before the Protestant Reformation. So this is a couple years before Martin Luther nails his 95 theses on the door of his local church in Wittenberg. And Teresa herself is to become a major player in what we call the Catholic Counter-Reformation. She wanted to clean up her church from within. Now, she's not the only person with that distinction in her time. Another figure I would mention is Erasmus, who was a very important Belgian-Dutch scholar who became wildly popular in Spain. He was very witty In fact, I recommend to you his ironic piece called The Praise of Folly, one of my favorite books ever. And so there were some scholars, such as Erasmus, who were talking about how to reform the church. But Therese's appeal was to everyday people. She's talking about how to reform your life, how maybe I could even reform my life. And it starts with working on yourself. It has to do with context for Teresa. The way you live your life has an impact on your thoughts and on your relationship with God. So it's not about rules and regulations. It's about fine-tuning yourself in terms of your relationship with God. Next, I'd like to talk about her in terms of gender. You may know that there was another important mystic in her own city at her time, Juan de la Cruce, or John of the Cross. He's important. I recommend him to you as well. The stereotypical story I've got to tell you is that he was her father confessor, and at one point he threw her letters into the road because he thought that she was being too rational, not sufficiently spiritual, and he was, of course, showing his authority by doing just that. But I want you to think about that story in a slightly different way that is as likely to be correct as the usual interpretation, and that is that John of the Cross was actually 27 years younger than Teresa, and she had recruited him, a young brother, also in the Carmelites, to reform the Carmelite order for men. So I suppose, only somewhat playfully, that another interpretation of that story might be that John of the Cross is throwing away her letters because he's once again telling him what to do. There are many readings, of course, but I want you to know that in terms of gender, she was actually very fortunate in many ways. The next point I want to talk about is actually her background. So she's from Avila. She's from north and west of Madrid. Her father was a businessman, and her mother actually was from the noble class. Perhaps the point, though, that's even more crucial is that although she was brought up in somewhat luxurious surroundings, her father's family were probably converted Jews. And so there was some feeling of unease among her family, always needing to prove that they were Catholic. And that is one strand in her story that I think I should mention. She apparently had difficulties as a child. Well, first of all, her mother died when she was 12. After that, she retained a close relationship with her father and with her uncle, and she loved to read, and she becomes pretty, and she loves fashion, and she buys clothes, and she becomes what we would think a typical young aristocratic woman of her time, but this doesn't make her happy. Starting in her teenage years and then definitely in her 20s, she started having nightmares, I'll put it that way, to begin. She was afraid that she was going to be persecuted forever for her sins. And she had very vivid dreams, and we have stories about them in her writings, of being attacked by wild animals, of being shut up in small places. I mean, some of those passages are worthy of Dante's Inferno, and the sad part is she felt that that was happening to her. So I've told you that a lot of noble young women and men were sent to monasteries and convents to actually solidify the power of the families, but actually Teresa's story is not like that. She ran away from home to join a convent. She felt that her life of parties and her burgeoning relationship with one of her male cousins was not right for her. This was a life that she had to turn her back on. She needed to find assurance within the church. The problem is that her health was delicate, to put it graciously. She had fits, she had spells, she couldn't sleep, She was unhappy. The convent was worried about her. They kept sending her home to recover. She went home at another point to take care of her father, but she still had this anxiety within her. And then she started to have visions in her 20s, and she didn't want to tell anyone about that because they would think she was crazy. And not only that, she wasn't sure where these visions were coming from. She didn't doubt the veracity of these visions, of these experiences, but she thought it was actually highly likely that they might be coming from the devil. And she felt that if that were the case, that this was something that she had to contend with herself to begin before she told anyone else. And so she was in this quandary that goes on for most of her 20s. Well, I've actually given you quite a bit of information about her and her background already. And I wondered if even now I might stop for just a couple minutes if any of you have comments and questions, and then I'll carry on. Okay.
That's really lively.
Oh, thank you. All right, well, I'll go on with a popular topic, and that's of Teresa's sexuality. You probably know that Teresa has been sexualized ever since her lifetime. She has not been seen as a normal nun. Again, I don't know what that is, but she wasn't one. She was seen as special. She was seen as different because of her family background, because of what she looked like. And somehow, then, more and more, because of her evolving relationship with God, which she expresses in her writings in explicitly sexual terms. Now, she's not the first one to do this. Medieval mystics have been doing this for much of 1,000 years. And they did it deliberately because we tend to wake up and listen when someone's talking about sexuality. I would argue, and this is a slightly boring interpretation, that they did it as a learning device. That whenever it's their most important topic, they somehow link it to sex, because you're going to remember that way. And she does this when she talks about our evolving relationship to God, how it starts with prayer, how it moves to contemplation, and then how it moves to what she actually considers to be a spiritual marriage with God. These are steps for her, which she actually describes in far more graphic terms than I just did. I also want to direct your attention to this tiny reproduction of Bernini's Ecstasy of Saint Teresa. And this is the image that has stayed with people through the centuries of Teresa interacting with her God. So how is Teresa actually different from other mystics? Well, again, if we're talking about 1,000 years of people who tended not to be in organized groups, how can I even talk about this? But I'm going to. I want to tell you that most mystics, I'm willing to say this, tended not to be part of an order. They tended to be isolated by choice. Some of them lived in trees, some of them lived in caves, some of them lived holed up in a wall, often of a church. So Teresa is, to begin, a very different figure in the mystical tradition, in that she cared deeply about moving out from her order and mixing with the people, especially the poor, never showing off that she had better education or better breeding, but trying to find points of contact with these people at all times. So, what she did step by step was to develop a reform movement. She thought in her 20s that she was very evil. Very sinful indeed. And I mean, this makes me very sad to think of in psychological terms, that she was so deeply persuaded of this. She felt that it was necessary for her to actually punish herself physically, to remove herself from all contact with her family, to change the order that she was in. She left the Augustinian order and she joined the Carmelites at this stage. Apparently you could leave one order to go to another order if you're going to a stricter one. And that's exactly what she was doing, although she thought even the stricter one was not strict enough. So this was her transition. And she had what we would now call real missionary zeal to try and change the church, especially the church in Spain at that time. And so she would go out with her cart and her mule, and she would tell her story about how we shouldn't show off all of our great advantages, but we should help others. And as you can imagine, she was not very popular for this. Exactly her own class background, the wealthy, the nobles, denounced her because they quite shrewdly recognized that this was a subversive message that she was proselytizing. She was suggesting that ordinary people had the right to make decisions about their own lives, first in the spiritual realm, but it's going into the social realm as well. If you as an individual, even as a young woman, had a right to say no to your father, that you were going to live an altogether different form of life. And of course, this also parallels the situation that was evolving in Germany in the time. Martin Luther, perhaps he didn't mean to spark the Protestant Reformation. We could talk about that another time, but there's no doubt that his Protestant Reformation sparked the peasants' revolt. German peasants who believed, yes, they had the right to choose their own form of worship, and they had the right to choose the political system under which they would live, and they wanted to be directly involved in that system, to be active political participants. So the Spanish nobles were very afraid that something akin to the German situation would happen in their own country. And so as Teresa got older, as she got to her 40s, and she had influence across Spain, oddly, Philip II tacitly approved of the reform that she was putting forward. I really need to do more research to figure that out. And yet, his nobles were very much against her. We know that she was imprisoned once in Toledo. We know she was threatened with the Inquisition explicitly once and implicitly throughout much of her adult life. And yet, it's of interest, and I'm actually persuaded by this. She said repeatedly that she did not fear the Inquisition. She said that it had no power to harm her. And you know, I actually believe her. Clearly, she could have been killed. She could have been maimed. But I think that her real fears were internal and were spiritual. And she seemed not to care about anything that would happen in the political realm. So, I mean, you really have this sense of a fierce, independent spirit going against this autocratic regime of her time and oddly succeeding. It doesn't seem to make any sense in logical historical terms how one woman who's not even using her family's wealth or connections could actually change the religious structure of her time, first in Spain, then in Europe, and then around the world. And I think that just the power of her personality, and of course she would want me to go on and say her connection to God, was what allowed this to happen. That she was an unusual character who felt that she could directly commune with God. She felt that she was talking to him. She was experiencing him. And this was not just the middle phase of contemplation of God, but it was actually a communion or a conversation, such as I think probably most of us can't even imagine. Let me go on and talk in a moment about her writings, but I'll give you another opportunity to talk or not. Okay. Well, you're a very receptive audience. I like the way you're letting me chat. I always like to do that. I'm like Teresa. I like to talk.
Oh, is an anchoress somebody? Is that the name of the walled up?
Yes.
I mentioned it in class the other day. Nobody knew what I meant.
Yeah. One designation of that.
Right.
Anyone else?
just find it amusing that the 20th century did not invent using sex to sell.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, we're rather coy about it now. You know, we have the double entendre. We have, even on television today, I think it was actually much more explicit in the Middle Ages. Oh.
Well, on that sex to sell, could it also be that, well, this is a language that we can't all relate to. Well, how do we describe that experience? And this is something that's, there's some affinity, there's some kinship, there's, that allows those concepts to come through.
Absolutely.
That is for that reason that language is used rather than because you're just trying to call attention to it.
Right. Yeah, I think it's all of those things, and I think that's a very gracious interpretation that you just gave. It's not just the educational, the mnemonics, the way to memorize the stages, and I don't think it's just for shock effect, but it's invoking this tender set of feelings and saying that it's even better when we talk about that in terms of God, as if nothing could be better. And of course, in a time when most of society was not literate, it's using a device that made sense instead of referring to great thinkers and what they said about this topic or that topic. It's talking about everyday human experience of longings and fulfillment and loss and fulfillment again. All of that plays out in her use of sexual imagery in her writings.
But if she's talking about marriage, sex and marriage, not marriage with God, that's really a difficult relationship, is it not?
That's of interest. She doesn't seem to think so. You know, so she, there's no sense that she...
The rest of us would.
Yeah, no, I think that's an intriguing point. For her, this seems to be a... Well... Doesn't seem to be right to say a marriage of equals when you're talking about a marriage with God, but that she felt free to talk to God, and she doesn't talk about her problems with him, only what keeps her from him. So in that way, of course, it's different from any other human relationship, including marriage. That's a good distinction. I hadn't thought about that. Okay, let me talk now about her writings. So she wrote books. She wrote poetry that became hymns, cantati, masses. So much of her poetry has been set to music, and it's regularly performed. You probably have heard her work through music, even if you didn't have it absolutely identified for you as such. So what she wants to do in her writing is to talk about her ascetic lifestyle. That doesn't sound very exciting. The life of giving up much that is considered enjoyable. But she wanted to talk about this ascetic lifestyle in terms of prayer and contemplation in particular. Her first book, and for some people her best book, is her autobiography, The Life of Mother Teresa of Jesus, of Jesus. And I want to begin here by admitting that a lot of people don't like the tone of this work because they feel that she's being mean to them. She's not sympathetic about their problems, and it's taking them much longer to get through the stages than she seems to assume is natural. The way I understand that is that she's not actually writing to me, the reader, or you, the reader. I think she's writing to herself. And that's, of course, sometimes in the title itself, to herself. I think she's impatient with her own failings. She's writing out how it should work, this evolving relationship with God. And she does sound like an impatient mother. She's hectoring at times. She seems to know the way, and it seems too hard, at least for me, maybe not you. But it's the story of struggle that many, many people through the centuries have found so compelling. And this work is considered to be perhaps the classic guide to contemplation and meditation. It's used by people from many different religious backgrounds and people without any religious beliefs. And it's often recommended to people as the starting point in a study of mysticism. The next work I want to mention, because almost no one does, and it's her Book of Foundations. She She actually wrote a more strategic institutional book about how to organize a convent, an order, and how it is that people can live together peacefully. I mean, I think that's extremely worthwhile, and it's a work that I recommend to people for different reasons, not because of mysticism. The next work is The Way of Perfection. And this is known by some people, but unfortunately, the one work, which you've already heard about, that gets all the attention, I think it's a little unfair because she wrote lots of good books, the one that gets all the attention is The Interior Castle. Well, it deserves this, sometimes called The Mansions. This is a book that discusses the human psyche, I would say, in modern academic terms. It discusses memory, humility, detachment, suffering, and ultimately self-knowledge. This is a book that takes the reader seriously and discusses how we interact as individuals, as rational creatures and as emotional creatures. And she gives us hope that there's a possibility that we can somehow have some union in ourselves, in our own psyche, not just with our relationship with God. She doesn't say it's easy or that the balance will be right on any given day. I mean, I think for some of us it's best understood maybe in terms of 19th century romanticism, that she believes that there's merit in rationality and merit in emotions, human emotions, not just the emotions we have towards God, and that all of that should be accepted as part of the human condition, even if not equally celebrated. Some of it you might want to push down, some of it you might want to bring up, but that this is how we're made, and that we have to somehow figure out these building blocks of our own psyche if we're going to interact with other people in society properly, and if we hope to have this relationship with God. And I would say, although she wouldn't say, if we're going to have a society that functions properly. She always goes just to the edge of a political argument, but it's really as far as most individuals were doing in her time and place. We have a few other things from her. We have about 31 of her complete poems and then fragments as well, and we have apparently 458 of her letters. So there's much work to be done on her other writings as well, and not just on the two most famous ones. So why are we studying Teresa today? I mean, literally today, in this room right now. And why is she still so popular? I have a few thoughts about this, and then I want to hear your reactions as well. Today, of course, she's not as well known for her work with her Catholic order or for helping the poor in her time, although I think those are models from Teresa we could actually call on, that she gives us other models of behavior that are also useful for us, but it's for her writings. And I would say, and now I'm going to go back to Augustine. I told you he was my starting point as I looked at Teresa. I would say that it's the interiority of Teresa's work that makes her so approachable and so popular with readers of very different types, that by reading Teresa, some of us realize that we're not the only one who felt that or considered that. You know, especially in a time before any kind of modern media, autobiographies, and there weren't many of them, one from Marcus Aurelius and Augustine and Teresa. These were a way that people tried to make sense of their own lives, even if they weren't the emperor of Rome, or even if their father wasn't a wealthy merchant. These were people who were revealing their needs, their longings, their doubts, and their successes. That all of us has a story with many different parts. So I would say that what we're getting from her in virtually all of her writings, except maybe the more technical ones about her order, is what the Germans call a Bildungsroman. This is literally a growing up story. She's telling the story of her emotional development, of her spiritual crises and change, and she's telling the story of how it's possible to come from a traditional nuclear family, to leave that family, to feel many different forms of separation, to even feel alienation, to have extraordinary personal problems. I mean, just not being able to sleep most of your life. That in itself is not at all trivial. And then that there's possible resolution. So that she gives this pattern of human development, which can be discussed in literary terms or psychological terms, certainly in spiritual terms, but she's giving us a sense that we're not the only ones who have felt that, and that she offers not just a high example of how we should behave, but she shows us that she's experienced some of the most extreme problems as well. Thank you. So, comments and questions, and then I've got some Teresa quotes. I don't know if you've all seen them that I'd like you to look at in a later stage, but I'd like to take comments and questions first before we do anything else.
So you discovered her by your search for people who read Augustine?
No, maybe I didn't explain that properly. It happened the other way around, that I was already reading these other people, and then I realized, how could it be that this one said that Augustine's confession was his favorite or her favorite? I thought, this doesn't make sense. I've never heard anyone talk about it, that one book could have such a profound effect on so many European writers in particular, and not just European writers. I'm slightly embarrassed to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you this. It'll be in my book when it's published anyway. But the final chapter of this book of Followers of Augustine's Confessions is on Bob Dylan.
Oh,
yeah. So, yeah. So it's not just in the past that people were reading autobiographies for inspirations and thoughts about evolving relationships with God. It's happening now.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I thought what we might do next, then, is I'd have you look at these Teresa quotes. This is from the Carmelite website, and it is a few of the best-known quotations from her. If you just read through front and back, and then we're going to talk about that. I'll have you first talk with the person next to you about this. So if you just read front and back of this, does everyone have one?
Worth saying twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well spotted.
Mm-hmm.
When you finish, would you just turn to one other person, preferably someone you don't know in this room, and discuss your initial reactions to these quotations?
Yeah.
Find someone you don't know and discuss, if you would. Yeah, you two definitely can't talk to each other. It's a married couple here. Well, here's another married couple. Let them on.
The Germans have been held by the volume, but with the Spanish, it's cheaper.
And before we talk together, could I suggest you find one other person in the room you don't know and continue this conversation?
Sure.
Maybe we can talk together for a few minutes. I have two questions now that I'm hoping that we can discuss either separately or together. The first one is, I really want to know what's been your intellectual surprise about Teresa, either from this discussion we've had here or your knowledge of her in the past. And the second one, see, this is really pushing me outside of my comfort zone, because in my classes we only talk about the text and we don't talk about modern interpretations, because I want my students to learn the text. But I feel Teresa is pushing me out of my comfort zone. So my second question for you would be, how might we use Teresa in the world in which we are living today, not just in our own lives, but also in a broader social and maybe political sense as well? So what has been your intellectual surprise about Teresa, and how might we apply her to the world in which we live in right now in 2016? Please.
I think that what surprised me was that she was not, you know, cloistered and by herself, that mm-hmm. she went out and dealt with people, mm-hmm. and yet she was so invisible.
Yes, okay. Right. She didn't lose that side at all. In fact, she felt she gained energy from that. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Other comments on surprises?
What surprised me is this idea of externalizing the vision.
Huh.
Of sort of living it out in the world, having these interior abnormal experiences, and so trying to express them in the world somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dave, did you have a comment?
Well, the idea that in other parts of Europe, the peasants revolt,
right,
and the impending threat that would have in Spain. So that was interesting to see yet another thing that was against her.
Exactly.
Yeah,
the Inquisition, mm-hmm. the threat of a peasant's revolt in Spain, so that all of her class was against her. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a lot. Yeah.
Just her bravery is what.
Yes.
Just her brave to embrace this way of life, going against, like a salmon swimming upstream, just against the grain, and then just the strength that she found in her mm-hmm. relationship. And it's surprising that she actually could talk to God. I imagine he answered her.
Yeah, it seems like.
Like, how did that work?
Yeah.
Surprised how long she lived.
Yes, I thought that too, given her health
and
the persecution of various sorts. And also it seems to me true courage that she possessed, because she didn't seem like a natural at all this. She was having to force herself out in many respects, even physically, to do this. And so it was coming out of her determination and her relationship with God.
Yes.
And how might we use Teresa today in 2016? If you were to write an op-ed piece, you were to write a letter to the editor about something happening in the news right now, how might you incorporate Teresa?
Which is what we've just talked about, and about her bravery and her ability to go out into the world. I believe that today, you know, a lot of times we feel paralyzed as individuals to express our beliefs what goes against the grain. And that's something that we can definitely use in our own lives, that our voice can make a difference.
For me, it's that whole concept of power, in the sense that there's the obvious representations of power that are brutal and violent and forceful. And then here's Teresa, who uses her relationship with God just to guide her through this morass, and the power that the power that wasn't even recognized as power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it was changing.
It was transformative.
Right.
That's great.
And the recognition that you can, in your weakness, you can take God's strength and still do great things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, against all the odds. I mean, that's just a wonderful example of that.
A frail woman was able to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
true
bit
frail.
Yes, genuinely frail. It's not, yeah.
Not just, she didn't just have a vapor.
Right.
No,
I'm afraid not. It was much worse than that.
It's encouraging that she fell apart and then came together then.
Yes.
And that she found that strength to get through all her, you know, breakdowns. And wasn't she the original insomniac?
It seems. Yeah. Well, there were a few before, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, she defined the word.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, did she have trouble sleeping her whole life?
At least as a teenager on.
Yeah. Yeah. Tough.
Yeah.
And she was able to do all that in spite of, you know, that gives me a lot of encouragement that, you know, it's okay to fall apart sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still draw on God's strength and do great, great things, or good things at least.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm inspired.
Yeah.
But she does encourage me to aspire greatly.
Yeah, and related to that comment, I don't think she realized she was doing great things, at least to begin. She was doing small things that she thought needed to be done. She was trying to change her own situation.
Right.
And then the situation in her first convent, and then our next convent, and the people there, and her relationship still with her family, and that these small steps didn't become something great. And that's encouraging, too, because I think very few of us think that we're actually doing great things.
Right.
But maybe the small things we're doing will contribute to a greater whole.
Right.
You know, that for me is very inspiring.
Yes.
So I think we only have 3 minutes left, so let me ask you just one more question. What else would you like to know about Teresa? I may not know the answers, but what has she made you think about that you'd like to know more about in her life, in her writings, in mysticism?
Toward the end of her life, was she cloistered?
No.
Never.
She was imprisoned. She was, she had to, at several points, even in her own home city. But she wasn't cloistered by choice in the way that we tend to think of it. When she could, she moved. And she spread her word.
What were the charges?
Well, there were so many charges against her. I mean, mainly that she was changing the existing system, and they cite particular rules, you know. She wasn't behaving properly. She was potentially, you know, causing rebellion.
Yeah.
All of those.
Yeah. Threat to the
established society,
right.
Both the religious society and the political society, and they were wholly intertwined, of course, at this time. Yeah. And what else might you want to know?
Did she have a love affair with God? I mean, St. John of the Cross talks about it in such a way that it's almost like, you know, he's your lover.
Yeah.
Did she was that kind of what it was?
Yeah, definitely. Let me end then by telling you about another much earlier saint. She was, not saint, mystic, Marjorie Kemp. And she actually fits the model that we have, the stereotypical model of a mystic, much more closely. She's from a lower social background. She also had fits, conniptions. My doctor friend tells me that she was probably epileptic when he reads her work, which she didn't write herself because she was illiterate. She had her son and others write it out for her. And she, too, makes me somewhat uncomfortable because she doesn't have the rational side that we get from Teresa. This is a woman who gained her extraordinary power as a Christian mystic through crying. She would cry. She would have fits in public places. And this was taken as a demonstration that God was speaking to her. So I think her book and her life is an extraordinary example of another woman gaining power in the most unlikely circumstances. And I actually thought of her just now because she too is explicit about her relationship, not with God, but Christ. And she's different members of the Trinity. And she talks about Christ coming to her bed every night. So this is a theme that runs through medieval and early modern mysticism. But I guess what I'd want to end with is just a sense of ecstasy and of joy that all of these mystics of different types thought was possible, that we don't have to accept the drudgery of our lives, that there's something else out there This is not in another country. It's actually within our ability to reach that joy and that ecstasy. And I'd say that that would be the thought that I'd like to end with. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, what a great way to finish our mystic lectures. Thank you all for coming. And Cecilia, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it.